Hello. Once again, welcome to the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Greyhawk.
And I'm your co-host and resident Maleficent apologist, Jax Sneflin.
Thank you for joining us for episode 20 of our Disney bracket. This week, we'll be discussing 1959's Sleeping Beauty and 2000's Dinosaur.
I mentioned we were talking about this one to my friend, and she said, oh, is that the really traumatic animated dinosaur movie from the 2000s? And I'm like, you're going to have to be more specific than that. I don't know what it is, but dinosaur movies for kids are always, like, traumatic and sad.
You are dealing with death in almost every single dinosaur film because dinosaurs no longer exist.
You don't have that with Robin Hood, the Disney movie we haven't talked about. Because, I mean, all those characters are also dead because they're living in the medieval era. So they're presumably also dead at this point, but we don't really have that sense of death and inevitability that Dinosaur gives us.
Robin Hood's not a terribly great example of this because anthropomorphic animals.
Oh, right.
With other Disney films, like, they're humans, so we can understand them much easier than we can dinosaurs, which are animals that no one has actually seen alive. I mean, I suppose that there's one that has just pricked its finger on a spinning wheel and just hasn't found its true love yet.
Under the Marianas Trench, because there's actually like a layer of cold water down there holding an entire ecosystem.
Somebody just watched The Meg, didn't they?
The Meg is really fun! Jason Statham steals your whole heart with his ruggedness and his PTSD.
We've rambled enough. Let's go ahead and get into point summaries from our previous episodes.
When we talked about Sleeping Beauty, we kind of disagreed. I love the art style. You, not so much, and that's okay. We got into the medieval rules of tincture and how the movie does not follow them. We tried to stab Maleficent for 5th edition, and then we were like, no, we need to rein this back. We talked about how Phil and Aurora are a step up for Disney love interest characters. They have some personality, and I have strong feelings about the specifics of their arc in terms of freedom and consent and trust and things. We talk about how the fairies are the best part of the movie because they're weird and have this not human morality, and how of them, Maleficent is the best of the best because she's such a great villain, even if her henchfolk are less so. And then we talk about some of the smaller failings, like how the fight scenes aren't that good, the foley isn't that good, the pacing needs a little work, but the face animation is pretty good in some places.
Meanwhile, in episode 8, when we talked about 2000's Dinosaur, we talked about how the animation holds up surprisingly well for a movie that is old enough to vote. Got into some of the nitty-gritty details with the Secret Lab, which is the sub-studio that Disney purchased to make films. They made this film and then soon after were shuttered. Talked about some of the unnecessary slow-mo bits in the film, how the film has these really good themes of communalism, but they're a little bit heavy-handed. While most of the dinosaurs are capable of communicating through speech, there's this one that's just a dog. We talked about how it actually passes the Bechdel test because of the plethora of female characters. It even gets into calling out catcalling as bad. But there's some weird stuff with the main antagonist, Kron, as a sexual gatekeeper for his sister. We talked about the subtext of Baleen and Ema, who we both read as a old lesbian couple. We also talked about the initial plans for the film and how it was meant to be dialogue-free and some of the shifts that happened to give us the final product. And we briefly touched on the short redemption arc that Bruton goes through.
So we came in knowing these were going to be very different movies, but they're honestly kind of the same thing, really. A child who, in the midst of a tragedy that strikes their home, is separated and raised by people who are a different species that don't really understand them. And a big part of the story is them trying to come back home through many trials. And in doing so, they find love and affection they've both been kind of dreaming of. And they have to fight a big toothy monster at the end. And they both pass the Bechdel test. Basically the same movie. Sleeping Beauty, but with dinosaurs. It's like how Jurassic World 2 is Dracula, but with dinosaurs. Jurassic World 3 should be Sleeping Beauty, but with dinosaurs. Also, they're both pushing the animation of the time ahead.
With Sleeping Beauty, they actually looked a lot at medieval tapestries and artwork and attempted to allude to the style of foreshortening and perspective. That's one of the reasons that the backgrounds in the film are weird if you think of them as representative of the actual physical world as opposed to the limited artistic understandings of perspective from medieval Europe.
Whereas Dinosaur is going for a very realistic style. Like, they were aiming for photorealism. For whatever reason, they felt that a movie with photorealistic dinosaurs would do really well in the 90s. And they succeeded pretty well. I still see the bits where, like, the animation doesn't quite work, but overall, they look like real dinosaurs.
The art style problems I have with both of these films is effectively the same. The backgrounds for both of these films look really good. The characters moving around in those backgrounds are really good. But when you put one on top of the other, there's this clash. For Dinosaur, it's not really the models or the textures, it's mostly the lighting. There are some points where it looks less like there's this creature that is occupying the space and more that it's kind of a paper cutout that they are animating above another plane. The shadows and perspective of the creature are just off. Most of the time it's fine, but there's a few scenes where it's very, very obvious, especially if you have a more bird's eye view. And then with Sleeping Beauty, they went for this medieval tapestry style for the background, but they didn't really attempt to emulate that with their character design. It's kind of Disney standard. And there's also a huge, drastic difference between the color palette of the backgrounds and the color palette of the characters.
The character color palette is your $8 Crayola, basically.
Yeah, and there's some weird neon colors going on in there. Like, there's bright green birds, and some of the choices for the nobles who are there for Aurora's christening, I guess, they clash a lot with the chosen color palettes for the castle and that sort of stuff.
It's a pity, because I think if they tightened that up, it could have been a really visually striking thing. Because the backgrounds use really great color mixings, especially Maleficent's castle, but also if you're looking at the main castle where things are taking place. It achieves brown by having greens and reds and purples all intermixed, and the forests have these very expressive plant life that has, like, twists and turns and gnarled roots and juttings out of the earth.
Boulders?
Boulders, yes, thank you.
Yeah, you mentioned Maleficent's castle. I think that's probably the only portion of the movie where the color of the characters doesn't clash with the background. You get these sickly greens and purples going on in Maleficent's dilapidated castle, and her henchmen are these, like, browns and olive greens and ochre yellows, and everything works there. But as soon as you get outside of that, the color palette is not restricted enough, and it feels weird.
Although, getting into colors, I paused Dinosaur for whatever reason.
You had to walk away after the Love Monkey bit, didn't you?
Oh, God, yeah, that was it. That was it. I was walking away from the Love Monkey bit.
What you need is a little help from the Love Monkey.
Anyway, I paused it and I noticed that the scales on the dinosaurs were a mix of all these colors. There was, like, yellows and greens and blues, and created a brown from all these different colors. And that's definitely what a lot of real reptile scales look like. You have these variations that achieve a harmony, and it's really cool. And I like that they have that detail there.
The textures on the dinosaurs in the film are pretty good.
Apart from poor Bruzon, everybody else gets to be this, like, nice, pretty, sloping faces, and his looks like it's got, like, boulders jutting out of his face. I'm not sure why my bit for this time is saying jutting with hand motions that people at home can't see, but...
Unless they stuck into their home, like we told them to last week.
That's true, exactly. A thing I noticed that was really interesting to me was the first time when Aladar is meeting Crone, and the music that accompanies Crone is very reminiscent of the opening of Les Mis. It's got that same kind of...
problem.
That's him, honey. Crone.
And it works really well because both Crone and Javert are these authoritarian figures that are keeping people in their place. I don't know if it's intentional. I keep hearing Les Mis in Disney things. Hunchback made sense for it, but I'm not sure why they're like, yes, Les Miserables with dinosaurs. But I salute them.
To be fair, Dinosaur on its surface does not seem like a movie that should work.
No.
It does somehow.
It's the heart. Again with music, when they're doing the whole, like, no, stand together bit, it should be silly, but you have this brass that is trying to make you feel it and trying to let you know that this is the message of the film, and it swells you like, yeah, yeah, yell at that dinosaur.
With your weird toothless mouths.
So they're supposed to have beaks, but they pulled the skin down so they'd have lips so they could emote. And it's a little weird, but it works in this case.
Yeah, I get why they gave them lips. I don't fault them for giving them lips, but it's just, like, whenever you see Aladar's weird-ass smile and it's just this, like curved brown bone protrusion, it's weird.
Yeah.
There's also heavy use of music in Sleeping Beauty to set theme. They reuse the melody from Once Upon a Dream 3 or 4 times in the film.
Yeah. Which, to be fair, not Disney's fault. Blame Tchaikovsky. I don't think Disney really does a lot of the whole taking existing music and making it their whole thing that often. And I'm glad, because I think they're kind of better when they make their own stuff as opposed to Fantasia, but a whole movie.
Yeah, I mean, you already don't come up with your own original stories. Please at least come up with your own original music.
They did, though, modify things so that the princes met Aurora before True Love's kiss to wake her up. Instead of just finding a castle, we'll see me being like, what happens if I kiss this lady? So what I'm saying is Philip is a D&D player.
Yes, obviously. And you know that he attempted to stab her first, and the DM was like, are you sure you want to do that?
Maybe it'll end the curse. Someone pointed out that Maleficent dies and the curse is still active, so that's Meriwether's curse, not Maleficent, because all of Maleficent's stuff goes away. Her dragon form, her thorns, that's all gone. That's just Meriwether having made this problem. She could have fixed it.
But we established that she couldn't. It was just her being able to lessen Maleficent's thing.
Right.
So it's effectively magical code written by Maleficent and then edited by Meriwether, but because the last edit was from Meriwether, it stayed active.
Right. It's like when you have a shared file on Google Drive and you delete it, but someone else is still using it, so it takes up your memory. Only other podcasters are going to understand the struggle, but but you understand.
Speaking of Meriwether, I feel really bad for her. A, she does not deserve half of the crap that she has to put up with the other two while they're living in the woods. No. It's very obvious that Meriwether is in charge of most of the daily menial tasks. It's also, she doesn't get to give a cool gift to Aurora.
She gives her the gift of not dying. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, but I'm sure Meriwether had something much better in mind, especially after the really boring gifts of beauty and song.
Oh yeah, she's gonna give her, like, force beams out of her eyes, or the Phoenix Force.
Or, like, math.
Or that.
I don't know, Meriwether seems very practical.
Yes, but what's more practical than being a vessel for the Phoenix Force?
I also want to know what textile merchant bribed Maleficent to have her cursed spinning wheel activated.
I'm just saying, if Disney wants to make like a really good live-action version of this story, if they want to make it about Maleficent, they should definitely make it about like the minutia of the textile industry. It would be so fun.
Is your goal with this episode just to get Disney to stealth reboot the Maleficent film?
Yes! It's so bad. I kind of like it. But it's very bad. Speaking of things I want a reboot of, I want a backstory movie for Baleen and Yima. Having these, in both movies really, having these old women be these major plot drivers is really cool and something you don't really see, and I'm sad that we have to pick from between them because I like all the old women in this narrative. Even though Flora and Fauna are a little on the useless side, I appreciate them as comic characters and I think they work really well. Meanwhile, we have Baleen and Yima, who are really fun. Yima has great lines, the whole thing. And then Baleen's bit where she talks about how
the worst of it is, you allowed an old fool like me to believe I was needed, that I still had a purpose. And do you know what? You were right. I'm going to go on believing it. I, for one, am not willing to die here.
One of my favorite archetypes is the Paragon, someone who inspires others by being a good person, and Aladar is a really good example of that. I like that we get to see that inspiring, you know, this old woman who kind of thought she was at the end of her tenure, and now she's like, no, I'm gonna keep going.
Also, all of these women give us pretty good body diversity. I mean, with the dinosaurs, it's a little bit weirder, but for the most part, they're the only examples of those species in the herd that's traveling. I mean, a vast majority of the herd is iguanodons.
And you see other ceratopsids in the thing, but none exactly like Yima.
And then with Flora, Fauna, and Meriwether, A, they all have very different body types from each other, and they're all very different to normal Disney women character designs, especially during this time period.
And to my knowledge, I don't think we have any fat jokes in either.
No, I don't think so. None of them get, like, stuck in a door as it's closing or things like that.
Mm-hmm. It could have been really easy to do that in the cave-in scene with...
with Ema and Baleen.
Yeah, but they don't, and it's great.
Yeah, like, the closest we get is where Baleen, she lifts her neck up too high and starts some of the cave-in.
Yeah, but that's more just about her having a remarkably long neck.
Yeah, and being in a cave.
Yes. Meanwhile, the only shaming that I can think of with the women in Sleeping Beauty is the bit where Meriwether says,
"It looks awful. That's because it's on you, dear."
I don't think it's so much shaming as more just her being catty, and I love it.
On that side of things. So, after the fairies decide what to do about the Aurora curse situation, we get the narrator back again, and he does his little info dump right before the time skip, and refers to Aurora as the king and queen's most prized possession.
Yeah.
And then when they're talking about everyone feeling sad that the princess has to go and live in hiding, they mention King Stefan and his people and don't even mention Aurora's mother.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we talked about it in the last episode how Queen...
I don't even remember her name.
I know she definitely has a name, but...
She has one. They mention it, like, once.
Yeah. We talked about how Aurora's mom gets shafted in this, and it's really sad. She has slightly more lines than Rapunzel's mom, but...
As much as I want to give Sleeping Beauty some props for being pretty good about female representation, there's also some of those unfortunate little bits.
Yeah.
Also, while we're here, I feel the narrator in Sleeping Beauty is really weird. We start the film off, and it's the typical storybook intro with the narrator, and then we cut to the party and the bestowing gifts and the curse and all that, and then we get the narrator again, and then I believe we get the narrator a third time, and the fact that the narrator keeps coming back and doing these information dumps feels really weird with how much of the film is just filled with nothing, just really extended filler scenes. I feel like they could have better used some of their time to show instead of tell all of that information that we needed.
You're not wrong. I like some of the filler scenes for building up tone and tension. Like, the build-up for Maleficent was really fun. The build-up of Philip hearing Aurora in the woods and the progress towards their meeting is good. But it is a weird pacing thing where, like, you have a lot of stuff going slowly that could definitely have been accelerated, and then the end is all one rushed long scene.
Mm. And the narrator never shows up there.
No. Also, you have the Scrump scene that we super don't need. Although, speaking of narrators, I don't think we need. There's a narrator in Dinosaur, sort of.
At the very beginning of the film.
And the very end, yeah.
Some things start out big, and some things start out small. Very small. But sometimes the smallest thing can make the biggest changes of all.
It's more like moral philosophizing than setting up a story. So it's not really narration, it's...
disembodied voice.
Yeah.
I believe of Aladar's mother, adoptive mother anyway.
Yeah, pretty sure so. And I feel like we don't need that. In a very naturalistic movie, it kind of pulls you out a bit because you're reminded that this is a movie because there's a narrator where most of the things are happening. It's just what we see on screen is what we get.
I think that might have been another holdover from when the film was going to be dialogue-free and they figured that they would need like a dialogue intro and a dialogue outro.
I can see that. Kind of said they didn't go full bore with it and have like somebody explaining these are dinosaurs. That's an iguana. It's not just... Have somebody just being that one kid from Jurassic Park, Michael, Trent, Philip, Sean, the one who isn't the hacker, just be like, that's an iguanodon, that's a brachiosaurus, that's an anachronism.
So you want like little...
Tim, that's his name, Tim.
So you want like little Zoobook pop-ups during the film?
I feel like there should be an option on the DVD for that. Circling back a little bit, While I love Baleen and Ima and the Iguanodons, I feel like I don't really care that much about the lemurs. You have four characters who all add up to about one total character on the whole, whereas I care individually about each of the three fairies.
Yeah, the lemurs, I think we have all of them mostly because it would have been too sad for Aladar to lose any of his immediate family.
Oh, for sure.
But they don't do enough individually to matter. Part of that is probably just due to their size, because they're dealing with much larger problems.
Yeah, and it divides the jokes up among them pretty well.
And honestly, I think the least useful is Grandpa.
Yeah.
Because Aladar's mom has a few good scenes, especially talking with Bruton and explaining why Aladar is doing what he's doing. Zeedee is there for comic relief. As much as I find him superfluous, there's no way they're gonna get rid of him in a kid's movie.
No, and he does at least feel like a fully developed character. He's Brock from Pokemon.
And then we have Suri, who is there to A, show off Aladar as kind and gentle, especially with children, and also to act as a bridge between Aladar and the two young orphaned Iguanodons.
I'll admit, I kind of get Aladar mom and Suri kind of blended into one character in my head. They're both kind of like good, gentle, nourishing mother figure women types. And in a movie with so many women, it would be cool to have a little bit more differentiation, but also there's a lot of characters, not a lot of time, and they don't really waste a lot of it. Most of the scenes of a dilly-dally do so for a reason, like the bit where Aladar first sees other dinosaurs that aren't predators, and he's just shocked to see other people like him, and it's really cool. And then he has the experience that all these other lemurs must be having, where he sees Baleen, and he's like, oh my god, she's bigger than me!
I think the only scene in this film that I thought overstayed its welcome was the lemur sex ritual.
Also, the egg getting to the lemur island.
Yeah, pretty much the front end of the film is a little poorly paced, but it's not too bad.
Yeah.
If we spent a little bit less time setting up the story, I think it would have been better.
And it's not awful. It's a really good spectacle. While the lemur sex island thing is a little bit weird, you do have to set up what it is that it's being lost and destroyed by the meteor. So I get it. It could have been something more interesting, although the music is nice and the animation is good.
I don't want to get rid of the scene completely. I just think it goes on a little too long.
We talked last time about Aurora and Philip's relationship and how it's actually really cool, but I do want to talk about how Neera changes because of Aladar, but she doesn't change for Aladar, and Aladar doesn't try to get her to change to win his affections or anything, or because he thinks there's something wrong with her. It's just a part of their interactions, and there's a lot of movies where the romance is about one person kind of pressing the other person into being a good person to be valid of their love. And here that doesn't happen. They threaded that really narrow needle by having her see, oh wow, this guy's really great. I'm going to be more like him. And they fall in love incidentally as part of that.
Mm-hmm. The gender politics in Dinosaur are actually really good. I mean, we've already talked about the entire scene in the movie that is literally just Neera calling out Zeedee for catcalling her.
Mm-hmm.
Although she thinks it's Aladar because Zeedee is hiding behind him.
Ow, baby!
Because those sound like noises that Aladar could make.
But there's so much criticism of toxic masculinity going on in this film.
Mm-hmm.
Just any interaction that Crone and Aladar have. Crone is toxic masculinity personified, and Aladar is never the one to instigate a fight. He is always seeking a diplomatic or peaceful solution to problems. Even when it comes to the Carnotaur, he doesn't try to rush it down. He just yells at it and gets everyone else to yell at it. It's like, no, we're big and strong, and if you try and hurt us, you're going to lose.
I think I do like is how both these movies have this theme of communalism defeating things that were undefeatable on its own. In Dinosaur, we have the whole yell at the monster till it goes away thing, which is great, and how Crone just cannot learn that lesson. But also in Sleeping Beauty, we have these three fairies who are all really terrified of Maleficent, and all these humans who are terrified of Maleficent. But at the end, the fairies and Philip can all band together and work together to make it through the Forbidden Mountain and defeat her and stuff. It's cool that they kind of learn to work together instead of all the bickering they've been doing for much of the movie. And then Meriwether just kills a man. Man, raven, whatever. He's a man in live action. That was a choice.
Can we just talk about really the only truly interesting characters in Sleeping Beauty are Meriwether and Maleficent.
Other characters are relatively interesting to me, but in a this is how they fit in the narrative sense, not in a, like, I would necessarily want to hang out with them all the time kind of way.
Yeah, like, outside of the narrative, I don't find anyone interesting. Like, Philip and Aurora are interesting because of the situation they find themselves in politically and dealing with Maleficent's curse. But I don't really care what happens to them afterwards. Mm. Whereas with Maleficent, I would be interested to have some sort of prequel thing to show where she came from. Probably not how Maleficent handled it. I don't know. I haven't seen the film.
Also, I was doing some digging, and apparently there was once a Maleficent song. It expands on how her evil is just for the evils. She just does it for the funsies.
Now the moon's pale light slowly fades from sight. Come to me, I decree, evil creatures in the night. Leave your nightmare home, goblin ghoul.
I understand why they cut it. It wouldn't have worked with the flow of the story. If they do a live-action version of Sleeping Beauty, I hope they bring that song back.
And then I would love to see a midquel of just Meriwether dealing with the other two fairies and trying to raise Aurora. That mm-hmm. sounds fun.
Kind of like Bewitched, but instead of the wife trying to hide her magic from her husband, it's Meriwether trying to hide the magic that she's using on the sly from the other two fairies.
Could be neat.
They feel very fully realized, and I think that's one of the strengths of Sleeping Beauty, is that you have these really dynamic characters who are clashing in these really fun ways, and I wish we had more of that. Mm-hmm. Which I think is something Dinosaur achieves, because all of these characters do feel real and dynamic. You know, a few exceptions here and there, but like even Bruton gets to be a real person who has agency and drives, even though those drives are not super helpful.
I don't necessarily hate any of the characters in Sleeping Beauty for the most part. It's just that they feel shallow, and I think some sort of reimagining and reevaluating of that narrative can fix a lot of those shortcomings that I see. I don't think it's anything insurmountable.
And there's stuff to work with there. Like, Philip is really funny with his horse. He got some just good, like, boy and his horse comedy bits that are fun.
Yeah, Samson's pretty good.
Yeah.
He's probably around Philippe on the best Disney horse bracket.
I'd say slightly below Philippe, if only because Philippe does go home and grab Belle and bring her back to the castle. So that's pretty useful.
Also, he's a Clydesdale that gallops upstairs.
That is pretty impressive. Those things are huge. You could, like, fit a small class of fifth graders in there.
That's a
weird thing that I said, and I regret it.
I was going to say, this could be a weird episode of Magic School Bus.
Sleeping Beauty has a lot of really good parts. The individual bits are better than anything in Dinosaur, but it also has some lower lows, and the inconsistency kind of brings it down a lot. Small tangent, but we got really pedantic with Sleeping Beauty last time, so we're going to get pedantic with Sleeping Beauty again. There's a bit where King Stefan toasts the Woodcarver's Guild, because they're going to be making cradles for his grandchildren soon. Yay! And I was like, oh, cool, Steph is pro-union. And so then I did some digging. But you mean, I asked my union friend, a guild and our modern idea of a union are very different. Guilds are much more like traveling professionals, as opposed to united labor groups that are really good and useful.
Guilds are usually people who own means of production and try to set prices so that they don't have to compete with each other.
And they limited the amount of guild masters to keep the prices high, basically. And I was really sad, because I'm like, oh, maybe there's something to wring out of Stefan as a character. But
yeah, guilds are a lot more close to multinational corporations in the modern day than unions.
Yeah, but smaller scale, because they can only go like a few days before they have to not be eaten by wolves, or whatever you did in France in the 14th century.
Now, Father, you're living in the past. This is the 14th century.
So we're getting pedantic about Sleeping Beauty. Let's go ahead and get pedantic with Dinosaur.
There are probably people out there who will tell you that it's not a good movie because the dinosaurs are anachronistic and you need to cut them out of your lives.
I do question how Aladar survived on the island of lemurs. Was there really enough food for him there? It's a very small island.
People have survived for like 60 days on three turtles and some of their crewmates in the sea. So I assume that he'd be able to make it. Realistically, he should have rickets. But he grew up to be a whatever the hunk version of a dinosaur is. Like, he'd be played by, I don't know, Tyler Posey or Colton Haynes or something in the live-action version. Live-er action. In the high school AU. in this high school AU of Dinosaur. I'm assuming that Ema and Baleen are teachers. What are their subjects? What do they teach?
Baleen obviously teaches English.
Yes. Yes, dear gods.
Ema seems like a political science or economics teacher.
Oh man, I'm into that.
Think we are picking the bottom of the barrel.
Yeah, we definitely are.
So let's go ahead and render our final decision. What moves on?
I'm going to say Dinosaur.
I'm also going to say Dinosaur.
It's weird. It's weird, right?
Yeah, it's definitely weird that Dinosaur is moving on to round 3 of our bracket. It's in the top 8.
No one has seen this movie, but it's doing better than many beloved classics.
Yeah.
By many, I mean 2.
And I mean, to give Sleeping Beauty some credit, it is the only classic princess film that made it out of round 1.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot going for Sleeping Beauty. There's a lot of reasons to love it. It has a special place in my heart, for sure. I think if we're analyzing it as a film, it definitely has some stumbling blocks that Dinosaur doesn't have.
We talked a lot about how Dinosaur is not a great, outstanding movie, but it's solid. It is doesn't have a whole lot of flaws, and it does pretty well. At some point, it's probably going to get kicked out of her bracket, but it's not here.
If you were a kid who needed folders for 6th grade and you found some that were themed for the movie Dinosaur because it just came out and you bought them, you would have a really good time using those folders. They were really good folders with a really good art design.
I think we just got some insight into young Jackson's early childhood.
I was a dinosaur kid and I grew up into a dinosaur adult. And also a whale kid who grew up into a whale adult. I'm a sort of Basilosaurus kid and adult.
There's also part of me that just loves the leftist politics of this movie that are not subtle.
They're not subtle. They're maybe not nuanced.
I mean, we're not saying that you should indoctrinate your children into Marxist ideologies, but if you're going to, Dinosaur is not a bad place to start.
When you decide to indoctrinate your children into Marxist ideologies, definitely start with Dinosaur.
Anyway, what do we have coming up next week?
We've got Tarzan versus 101 Dalmatians. So, yay, 2 talking animal movies.
I really enjoy both of those films. This is probably going to be a tough week for me for that decision.
They're both quite good in different ways, and we're going to have to see what wins out. Thanks for joining us this week. Dinosaur's moving on. Sleeping Beauty has to be put to bed. And if you like us, then press the like button and tell your friends. Share this. If you're going to a christening and you have to give a blessing to the baby, give them the complete gratuitous pausing so far on a flash drive.
Honestly, I'm not even sure flash drives are going to be, like, a thing in, like, the 10 years when that kid is going to be able to use them.
No, but they'll have a relic to show off in show and tell.
Anyway, if you would like to hear more of our nonsense next week, make sure to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, follow us on Podbean. Until then, we'll catch you next time.